November 4th, 2007, Sunday Feast, Auckland, New Zealand.
Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Vichinam Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pacharani Nirvisesa Sunya Vami Paskacharya Sitarani Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Vital Padakamalam Sri Guru Vaishnavam Sri Sri Rupam Sagujatam Sagana Raghunatam Vitam Stavadam Sadvaitam Sadvaditam Parijana Sahitam Sri Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Param Sagana Bhavitam Sri Vishakam Vitam Stavadam Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya I'm going to look at the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 7, text 4. And here Krishna describes the whole material nature, both gross and subtle. He says, Bhumira panalo vayu, kammano bhudire vaja, ahankara iti yame bhina prakritir ashtita. So Bhumir means, what does Bhumi mean? Earth. Okay. Apaha means water. Anala, fire. Vayu is air. Okay, Kam is ether. We're going to look specifically at Vayu. Krishna says here, earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego. Altogether, these eight constitute my separated material energies. So I'd like us to think about how we can meditate on Krishna through air. Because Krishna informs us in the eighth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, in the next chapter, that whatever we think about determines our body. Correct? It says, Yam yam vapi saram bhavam tvaja chante kalevaram tam tam evaitikantaya sadatad bhava bhavita. Whatever we think about, that determines what kind of body we get. That determines what kind of situation we get. Because each of us has a particular body. We look in the mirror, we see a particular body, we have a particular family that we're born into, we have a certain amount of wealth, we have a certain amount of education, of intelligence, of beauty, of creativity. And we have that because of what we have thought about in our previous lives. Not only what we've thought about, but what we've done. But what we've done isn't very much in relationship to what we've thought about. Whatever has been the most important thing to us in our various lifetimes is what's given us this present body. So who here can say that they're completely satisfied with the situation they have in this life? Anybody? They think their body, their family, their money, their intelligence, everything's perfect? Anybody think it's perfect? I haven't found anyone yet who said yes. So Krishna does tell us how we can get a perfect body. Actually, it's our real body, our spiritual body. Originally, we are part and parcel of Krishna, and we have our own spiritual body, which right now is dormant. It's something like a plant is hiding in a seed. That body is sleeping. So we can reawaken that body by thinking of Krishna, because we are part of Krishna. So how to think of Krishna? Thinking of Krishna for most people in this world seems very difficult and esoteric. It doesn't seem to have much relationship to their everyday life. People will say, well, how can I think about Krishna? I have to get my children ready for school. I have to go to work. I have to go to university. I have to pay the bills, I have to drive in the traffic jam. So many things are on my mind. How can I possibly think about Krishna? But if I can't think about Krishna, if I'm thinking about all the things of this world, well then again, I'm going to get another material body. So we have to work in the world. Krishna is not suggesting to Arjuna that he externally renounce the world. Arjuna keeps thinking that this is what Krishna is saying. He keeps saying, if you want me to do Buddha yoga, why are you telling me to fight? And Krishna says, no, you fight and think of me. right after Yam Yam Vapi Smaru Brahman, he says, Mam Anusmaram Yujya Cha. You think of me in fight. So how do we think about Krishna? How do we do that while we're in the midst of our lives? How do we become a really spiritual person even while we're going through our life? If we did that, not only would we get the revival of our spiritual body, but also in this life, we would become completely happy. Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma Nasochitina Kanchati Samasarveshu Bhuteshu Madhbhakti Mlavate Brahma. We would become Prasanatma, full of joy. Can we say that we spend even 24 hours in our life and we were just full of joy? A week? A month? Maybe a few minutes. Maybe a few hours. But who of us have spent a week or a month with absolutely no anxieties or difficulty? But by thinking of Krishna, we can become over-flooded with joy. So our next life, we will awaken our spiritual body. And in this life, at this moment, we can become over-flooded with joy. And Krishna explains in the sixth chapter that this consciousness is actual freedom from material miseries. Usually we try to become free of material miseries by external means, just like it's raining. So I brought an umbrella, and I have a jacket. But does that work? I get a house, a jacket, an umbrella, and money in the bank. Does that free me from all miseries? No, unfortunately it doesn't work. The real way of becoming free from miseries is to change one's consciousness. To put one consciousness in Krishna. Krishna is always joyful. You see, he's always playing his flute and dancing. He's always joyful. So by thinking of Krishna, we get our spiritual body revived, we become full of happiness, and we transcend all material miseries. We're no longer engaged in material miseries. It's something like going in an airplane where all of a sudden all of the houses look very, very small, and after a while you can only see a general geographic features. So when we transcend the material world by thinking of Krishna, all of our problems seem very insignificant. We're no longer affected by them. We can deal with them with detachment. So we get our spiritual body next life, we become full of joy, and we become free from miseries just by thinking of Krishna. But we come back to our original question, which was, how do we do that? It seems my mind is full of my children, my home, my work, my studies, my car, my house, right? How do I think of Krishna? So here's a little hint in this verse where Krishna says that earth, water, fire, air, ether are all his separated energies. And the wonderful thing about Krishna, as explained by him in his form as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, is that he and his energies are non-different. Krishna's energies are Krishna. We can say Krishna's not his energies. At the same time, he is his energies. So we're going to look today at air and how we can use air to help us meditate on Krishna in whatever circumstance we find ourselves. So let's think for a minute about air. Now, sometimes we're very hot and sweaty, and just having some air blow on our body gives us such relief. Or the pleasure that we find in taking a deep breath of air that nourishes all of our cells and allows our proper digestion to take place. We use air to fly kites, to fly in airplanes. I think I can figure most people who live in New Zealand have been on an airplane, since it's a small island. And we're doing so many wonderful things by dint of the air. So let's think of the qualities of air. One quality of air is that it's very subtle. Can any of us feel the air in this room? Can you feel it? Not really. It seems like there's nothing there at all. Now, I know that there's air, but I can't feel it. So in a similar way, Krishna is also here. Maya tatam idam sarvam jagadavyaktam vartinam matstani sarvabhutani nacharam desitam. Avyakta, he says, I'm not manifest, but I'm everywhere. So although Krishna is everywhere, we're not able to perceive him. Now, we can perceive air if it starts to move. Right? If air starts to move, then all of a sudden we can feel it against our skin. So sometimes Krishna makes himself manifest, but that has to come from Krishna. We cannot force him to be manifest. He becomes manifest out of his own sweet will. Now, not only can we not perceive that the air is around us, we can't even perceive that it's pressing on our skin. Oh, I should have looked up the metric equivalent, but in my own American system, it's 14 pounds of pressure per square inch. So I don't know what that translates to. I should look that up. And how many kilos per square centimeters. But 14 pounds is a lot. What's that? It's probably around, 5 or 6 kilograms. And a square inch, it's about 2.5 centimeters each way. So about 5 square centimeters, 5 kilos on every 5 square centimeters. Do we feel that? That's a lot of weight pressing all over our body. Of course, it's also pressing from inside our body, and therefore it's equalized, and we can't feel it. In a similar way, Krishna is pressing and controlling everything that's going on, Ishvara Paramaha Krishna. But we don't notice his control. We feel in this world very free. Actually, real freedom is in the spiritual world. So just like we don't feel the bondage of air pressing on us, we don't feel how Krishna is actually controlling everything, either directly or through the three modes of material nature, divyation, vinimaya. Now, although air is very subtle, it can move things that appear to be more substantial than itself. Right? Air doesn't appear to have much substance, but air can push very heavy things, isn't it? You can put a big chair outside, and if the air is blowing strong enough, it can knock the chair over, or in a cyclone, or I don't know if you have any tornadoes here, but in America we have tornadoes that, again, I should look up these metric equivalents, but tornado can go at 300 miles an hour. That's probably about 500 kilometers an hour. And a tornado can pick up a little piece of wood and push it through a wall of steel. It can take a whole house and pick it up and transport it and put cars on the top of roofs and things like that. So although Krishna is very subtle and imperceptible to us, generally speaking, he is able to move and control everything within this gross world. The thing that's most amazing that he can change, just like a tornado or a cyclone can penetrate a steel wall, is that Krishna can penetrate our steel hearts. That even though our hearts are full of so many material attachments, our hearts are full of so many things, like we may feel sometimes greedy or envious or lusty or angry, and these bad qualities cause us so much suffering. Still, Krishna, even in such a subtle form as the sound of his name, Krishna, which appears to have no substance, one cannot grasp the sound Krishna in his name, but just by Krishna's name, he can penetrate our steel hearts and have them melt in ecstasy and compassion. So also we find that air is everywhere, but it doesn't mix with anything. It always retains its own quality. So if you're going by a garden of roses, the air carries the smell of the roses. And if you're going by a garbage dump, the air carries the smell of the garbage dump. But although the little molecules of odor are being carried by the air, they don't actually change the chemical constitution of air. So in a similar way, Krishna is always with us. Ishvara Sarvabhutanam Hridayesha Jinatisthati. He's always with us. He's always in our heart. He's aware of what we're thinking. If we're thinking rose-like thoughts, he's aware of those. And if we're thinking garbage dump-like thoughts, he's aware of those. But he himself is not affected. And according to our thoughts, he arranges for us to get the results of our karma. He arranges for us to get various bodies. But he is always situated as though neutral. He is not affected. He is just carrying us along to our next destination. We can also say that our most essential need is air. Right? Everything else we can live without for a while. What's our next most essential need after air? This is a trick question. No, it's not water. You can live without water for between 3 to 18 days. What can we not live without? It takes about half an hour to an hour to die from this problem. After air, anybody know? Temperature. Temperature. If it's too hot or too cold, we won't be able to live. So our primary need is air. We can only live a few minutes without air, at most about 10, 15 minutes. We can live maybe a half an hour to an hour without the proper temperature, a few days or a week without water. But air is the most essential thing that we need. In the same way, Krishna is most essential. We have so many things in our life that are so important. We have to do. We have to take care of this. We have to take care of that. I have to do this. I have to see this. I have to be with this person. I have to have this. And so many things. But just like we may want a good meal and a glass of water and a roof over our head and present company and a nice family, but if you don't have air, it's all finished. So if you don't have Krishna, everything else has no real value. It's not going to bring us actual satisfaction. Actually, the satisfaction we find in everything else in this world is because it has some connection with Krishna. Because Krishna is earth, water, fire, air. He's solids, liquids, gases, space, everything. And therefore, whatever we find is dear, it's actually because Krishna is there. We like our house. Our house is made of trees. Trees have gotten their energy from the sun, from the earth. That's all Krishna. We like our family members, but each of them is part of Krishna. If we can feel so much love for our wife, our husband, our son, our daughter, just imagine how much love we can feel for Krishna, of whom that person is a part. So really the most essential aspect in everything that we do is Krishna. And therefore, one should put Krishna first, just like we put breathing first. You know, not that, oh, I'll do so many things and then I'll find time for Krishna. We don't say, well, first I'll eat, first I'll get a proper temperature, then I'll drink water, then I'll eat, and then I'll breathe. No, first you breathe. Therefore, we say that every morning, first thing one should do is give some time to Krishna. I put Krishna first in the day. First I have to breathe. At least some time just to be with Krishna. Just like I would a very sweet relationship with my father, that every morning from the time I was 2 until I went to university, he used to spend about 2 hours with me. And when I was a little girl, he'd play games with me and tell me stories. And when I was older, we used to talk about things. He'd make my breakfast. He would make fresh orange juice. My mother used to go to bed late and sleep late, so I didn't see her in the morning. And because of him spending that time with me, I became very, very attached to him. And he was a busy man. He was the CEO of a multinational company. He was in charge of his local temple. He was the temple president of his local temple. He had so many responsibilities, but he still made 2 hours every day for his little daughter. And because of that, I was basically, whatever he wanted from me, I would do. I mean, just like when I was 3, he started telling me, don't ever smoke. And even though most of my friends in secondary school smoked, I never smoked, just because I wanted to please my father. And what won my heart was that he would spend that time with me every day. He made me feel like I was the most important person and activity in his life. So if we understand that Krishna is the most essential aspect, that God, that spiritual life, is the most important thing in our life, just like air, then we'll give Krishna our time. Actually, chanting Hare Krishna, reading Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, it's like spending time with Krishna. Krishna's there in his name, and he's there in his Bhagavad Gita. It's not that this was spoken thousands of years ago, and now Krishna's gone, and this is just some words in a book. But this book is spiritual. And as we read it even today, Krishna manifests. And he very much would like us to spend some time with him. So also in the sense of that air is the most essential, it's arranging for everything else that we need. Air is arranging for all of our digestion. You know, digestion takes place due to a chemical fire in the stomach. And what does fire need in order to burn? Fire needs air, needs oxygen, needs fuel, and it needs oxygen. So the food we eat is the fuel, and the air we breathe provides the oxygen for that chemical fire. So therefore, the air is allowing for all of our necessities. In the same way, Krishna is providing for all of our necessities, even for ordinary people, even for animals. Just like there's these birds. What are these birds called? Pokiko? Pokeko? Yeah, really ugly, noisy birds. So they're ugly birds and they're noisy birds, these pokekos. But still Krishna's taking care of them. He's giving them worms and bugs to eat and whatever that they need for their sustenance. Krishna's taking care of poisonous creatures like cobras. He's certainly taking care of all the needs of all living entities. And for one who becomes his surrendered devotee, yogakshema vadamyaham, he supplies all of their necessities. We can also think about how air, when it moves the trees and the plants in such a way that they almost appear to be dancing. The great Vaishnava poet Kavi Karnapur talks about how in the spiritual world, the trees and creepers are dancing by the instructions of the teacher of the wind. So we see the trees and plants dancing in the wind, and sometimes especially when the leaves are rustling, they seem to be doing a very intricate, choreographed dance. Air also blowing makes intricate patterns on things like water and sand. If you've ever been to a desert, I recently spent some weeks in the Arabian Peninsula, which naturally is all desert. Now they're bringing in soil and they desalinate the water and irrigate things. Everywhere there's signs, you know, don't use water, don't use water, don't use water. Very strange countries. They have no natural supply of fresh water. But anyway, the air blowing on the sands, it creates beautiful patterns in the sands. It creates the different dunes, almost like waves and ripples in the sand. And it creates beautiful patterns even in rock. If you see some desert, the air has eroded the rock to look as if there was made sculptures created by an artist. And in the water, we see the different patterns and eddies and waves created by the air. So this can remind us of Krishna's gracefulness. We see here how Krishna is dancing. So Krishna is always engaged in dancing. Lord Brahma says that in the spiritual world, every step is a dance. Now that doesn't necessarily mean that they're all dancing like in a Bollywood movie, you know. But each of their movements is so graceful that it's more graceful than a dance. What to speak of when they're literally dancing. And the dancing of Krishna and his associates cannot be compared to anything of this world. Sometimes Krishna dances with his cowherd boyfriends, and sometimes they're dancing, and Krishna says, oh, you are dancing very nicely. Krishna likes to praise the qualities of his devotees, and sometimes he's dancing, and the cowherd boys are praising him. Oh, Krishna, how nicely you are dancing. Sometimes they imitate the way the peacocks dance, right? Peacocks have kind of a funny dance. They dance mostly with their rear, right? Shaking their tail around with their neck. And so Krishna and his friends, they'll imitate that kind of dancing, moving their neck and shaking their backside in a kind of a funky way, like probably some modern dancing. Actually, everything in this world comes from Krishna. So Krishna has his very graceful dancing and also his kind of wild peacock dancing. And then, of course, he's dancing with the cowherd girls. We see here the very famous Rasa Leela dancing, where Krishna is expanding himself to be between every two gopis so that each gopi thinks, oh, Krishna is only dancing with me. This is how wonderful Krishna is, that he has a personal, intimate relationship with each of us. And we shouldn't think that because there's so many people, so many living entities, you know, I'll just be on the outside. Krishna has his relationship with so many people. Where's the place for me? In this world, we all want to have the attention of someone we love. A wife wants her husband to pay attention to her. She says, put down your newspaper, turn off the TV, spend some time with me, right? And the husband's saying, finish up the dishes and be with me. And the children are saying, Mommy, Daddy, be with me, right? If you have more than one child, they're competing for attention. But with Krishna, it's not like that, because he can give attention to each of us simultaneously. And each living entity is thinking, I'm Krishna's favorite. Krishna's just looking at me. So in his Rasa Leela dance, each gopi was thinking, I am Krishna's favorite. Krishna's only dancing with me. And Krishna's even dancing when he's chastising demons. We have the Kaliya serpent with many hundreds of hoods. And Krishna, as a little boy, right, he's only like 7 years old, he jumps on the hoods of Kaliya and he's dancing. Now, normally, just to dance beautifully on a solid stage is very difficult. Imagine dancing on a stage that was in many different pieces, and the pieces were moving up and down. So Krishna's dancing like this on the stage of Kaliya's hood, jumping from one hood to another. And what would happen is, as he danced, he pushed down one of Kaliya's hoods, and another one of Kaliya's hoods comes up to attack him, and again he dances and pushes that one down. And not only are the hoods always moving, but the Kaliya snake is spewing fire and poison. So imagine dancing on a stage made out of moving fire and poison. But yet Krishna was very gracefully dancing. And the acharyas say that he was dancing so beautifully because he was trying to show off for the cowherd girls who were falling in love with him. So, of course, ordinary men do that in this world. They try to do something very athletic and very strong so that women will be attracted to them. And so Krishna also has this tendency that he likes to demonstrate his prowess for his devotees. And just like the air is forming these beautiful patterns in the sand or in the water, so the dancing of Krishna is very artistic. As he's dancing with his circles of gopis, who number in the billions, and they are in concentric circles. So each circle is forming an intricate pattern. Actually, Prabhupada says in his commentary of the Krishna book, in his description of this Ras dance, that the whole world is full of Krishna's singing. Scientists who study the molecular and atomic constitution of things talk about how there's repeating patterns. There's certain numbers that tend to repeat in nature and certain patterns that tend to repeat in nature. Perhaps these are indicative of the harmonious, beautiful singing of the Lord as it represents itself in the gross forms of this material world. Now, Krishna himself also has many pastimes in relationship to air. So how is it that the Lord has pastimes? This word pastimes is what Prabhupada uses as the English translation of the Sanskrit word lila, or sport. So pastimes indicates that it's not something that one is obliged to do. Just like for us, if we don't cook, we don't eat. If we don't grow food, or we don't have some job, we don't eat. Right? If we don't work, we can't live. We're obliged to do these things. It's not like it's just for fun. People like to have a job that's also enjoyable. There's one scientist, Mikhail Csikszentmihalyi is his name. He's from Czechoslovakia, so he has a long Czechoslovakian name. And he says that the ideal is when your work and play merge into one, when you feel your work to be like play. He says he calls this flow. Have you ever experienced that? You ever doing some work that's so pleasurable that it's like flow? Maybe some of us have sometimes. So for Krishna, all his activities are like that. They're all simply play. There's no obligation. Okay? We have some things like that. Maybe we have some hobby or some sport or something we do without obligation. We do it simply because we enjoy it. So Krishna has nothing he has to do. He's Atmarama. All of his desires are fulfilled. Well, why not? He already is everything. And one time he was joking with his wife, Rukmini, and he said, "I am penniless." He said, "Why are you married to me? I don't own anything. I have no wealth." And she countered by saying, "My dear Lord, you don't have to own anything because you are everything." So there's no question of ownership when everything is actually an expansion of you. So Krishna, because he already is everything, what does he have to accomplish? He's already fully satisfied within himself. And even if you can say he has some desires, he's not only Atmarama, he's also Aptakama. He can fulfill those desires by himself. For me, I need to get food, right? I can't just manifest my own cessation of hunger. If I'm hungry, I have to go outside myself to satisfy my hunger. Whereas if Krishna feels hungry, he can satisfy that hunger by himself. He doesn't need to take anything separate to himself. And in one sense, you could say, there is nothing separate to himself. So because of this quality of his, that he is everything and that he's able to satisfy his own desires, many people think that the Supreme Lord must do nothing. He's just existing. Just floating and existing. But that's not very much fun, is it? So sometimes after a very hard day, we may just want to lie down and just float and do nothing. But we don't want to do nothing forever. Again, we want to come to some activity and some relationship for enjoyment. So Krishna engages in activities only for sport, only for lila, only for pastimes. Therefore, his activities cannot be compared to our activities in this world. And actually, one who understands this divine nature, as Krishna explains in the fourth chapter, janma karma ca me divyam evam yo veti tattvataha tvaktudeham punar janma naiti mam eti sorjana. If we understand that Krishna's janma, his appearance, and his karma, his activities, are divya, are divine, then tvaktudeham, when we give up this body, we will no longer have to come back to this world, because we'll be absorbed in Krishna, as we started to say in the beginning, thinking of Krishna. So Krishna has some lovely lila in relationship to air. Right? He likes to fly through the air, and he flies through the air on the back of Garuda. He doesn't take Air New Zealand or Qantas Airlines or something like that. He has his own carrier. There's a big eagle, and he stands on the back of this eagle, just like some kind of tightrope walker in the circus who's balancing. So he's balancing on Garuda as he's swooping through the air. And he even fights battles on the back of Garuda. And just imagine, that's better than any video game. And he's standing on the back of this giant intergalactic eagle, and he's throwing his Sudarshan disc at his enemies as he's flying through the air. And Lord Navayovana, he's always youthful. He never ages beyond like 16 or 20 years. So, you know what 16, 17-year-old boys are like, right? Those of you who remember being one, or either you've been one or you know one. Some of you were not quite there. So 16, 17-year-old boys, they like adventure. They're very playful. So the Lord is also like that. He's very playful, riding on the back of Garuda. And he also, in this material world, has some pastimes in relationship with air. He expands as Karunadakashaya Vishnu, Yakaranana Vajaleya Vajati Swayogam Nidram Mananta Jagananda Saramakupadara Shakti Mabalambya Paroksamurti Govinda Madhipurusham Dhammahumayam. So in this huge form, this Mahavishnu, he's lying on Sesha and he's breathing. Now, when I breathe, in my breath, there's all kinds of little organisms, right? If you could capture, if I breathe into a bottle and you could look at that bottle under a microscope, you'd find that there were little creatures. But when Mahavishnu breathes out, there's universes. And we're in one of those. So just like to the little creature, their world is their whole universe. So to us, this world is our whole universe. But to the Lord, it's very insignificant. So as he breathes out, all these universes expand, not only from his nostrils and mouth, but from all of his pores. We're also breathing out through our pores. We have some respiration through all of our skin. So he's breathing out, and all these universes are manifesting, and they're gradually expanding and getting bigger and bigger, and then they contract, and as he inhales, they all gradually re-enter the Lord's body. It's sort of interesting that the scientists talk about how our universe is expanding and contracting. Actually, according to the Bhagavatam, our universe has now just started its contraction phase because Lord Brahma lives for 100 years, and the first 50, the universe is expanding, and the last 50, it's contracting, and he's now 51. He's 51, and it's about 20 minutes before his lunchtime. I'm not sure on what day of the year I'd have to look that up. Now also, the Lord breathes out the Vedas. So Vedic knowledge is given at the beginning of the universe, and that's also through the Lord's breath. The Lord puts his breath into his transcendental flute, and the Lord's breath going through his transcendental flute enters the heart of Brahma, Ene Brahma Hridaya Adikavaye, and this breath of the Lord through his flute that enters into the ears of Brahma and into his heart manifests as Gayatri. And through this Gayatri mantra, Lord Brahma then gets the knowledge to create the universe. It manifests as all of it. It comes out of Lord Brahma's mouth as all of the Vedic knowledge and all of the means of creation. Then again, periodically, the Vedic knowledge is lost. Sometimes Dharma becomes lost, and then again the Lord manifests to recreate it. So sometimes the Vedic knowledge is lost, then the Lord appears as Hayagriva with a horse's head. And it says he just breathes, and the air coming out of his nostrils manifests the sweet sounds of the Vedas. So not only is this air coming out of his nostrils full of Vedic knowledge, but it sounds very sweet. So if I breathe out of my nose, it doesn't hardly make any sound. What to speak of a sweet sound? What to speak of containing knowledge? But these are some of the Lord's pastimes with air. Of course, the Lord favors a wind instrument. There are many different kinds of instruments, percussion instruments, brass, but he favors a wind instrument. And it said that the wind blowing through Krishna's flute, it carries the sound of the flute, and it also carries Krishna's fragrance to all of the devotees in Vrindavan, who then become very enlivened with love for him. So thinking of Krishna is very easy. It's not a difficult thing. Air is so much a part of our life, we cannot live even for a few moments without air. Because Krishna is also present in air, and that means every time we're breathing, we're actually having a relationship with Krishna. And just like we've gone through this meditation on air, one can go through a similar meditation on all of the different aspects of our life. This requires, of course, some little effort on our part, but it is part of love. Love is manifest in effort. Bhakti is love. A love is not just something sentimental. It is something that you do. If the woman says to her husband, I love you, but she never cleans a house or cooks a meal, never gets out of bed, he's going to wonder, how much do you love me? If the man says, I love you, but he just sits on the couch all day watching, you know, the football games and never goes out and earns a living, the woman is going to wonder, how much do you love me? So if we really want to talk about love of God, that means that we meditate on him, manmana bhavamadbhakto. We absorb our mind in thinking of him. And it's so wonderful that everything that's around us, even something so basic as air, can constantly remind us of the Lord's qualities, of the Lord's pastimes, and our relationship with him. So we have about, my watch says 15 minutes and this clock says 10 minutes. We have a little bit of time for questions, discussions, whatever you'd like.
I have just one question.
Yes, sir.
It may not be really related to this activity, but since you are coming from America, is it a chance for you to share your views? What is the total overall attitude of Americans towards this connectivity?
Well, I haven't. Let's see, when was the last time I was in America? I was in America, I guess, in April for a while. I don't know if we could say that overall. I mean, the Hare Krishna movement started in America, and when it first started, people didn't pay much attention to us. The first few years, nobody even noticed we were there. Then after a while, they thought that we were a botheration because we were selling our books in public places. But then they decided that we were a dangerous cult, and now we're pretty much just part of the general landscape of the country. The Hare Krishna movement in America has become much more part of mainstream American life. So the majority of our members in America no longer live in temple ashrams. They live outside. They have their own businesses and their own jobs and so forth. And we're sort of infiltrated the society as a whole. So that's what I see there. Yes?
Why is that Krishna black?
What should he be?
I don't know. Why is he black?
Oh, why is he black? Well, Krishna's color really cannot be described by any color in this world. His color is described as shana, kind of bluish black, sort of the color of a rain cloud. But it's a spiritual color. It's not, I mean, the black of this world is just simply in relationship to what parts of the spectrum of sunlight a particular object is absorbing. So to ordinary people, like me, you know, when I look there, I see that there is a piece of marble that's been carved in the shape of Krishna, and it's been carved out of black marble. But that's not actually the whole story. Because Krishna is everything. He's also earth, and he's also stone. And therefore, he can manifest himself in stone. And he's also the same as his form. See, I'm not the same as this form. Just like, is that your sister sitting next to you? So I used to have a little body, something like that. Not exactly like that, but something like that. It was about that size, and I don't know if I was quite that cute, but I had a body something like that. So where is that body now? You can't just say it grew up. It's not like you just took that little body and pumped it full of air like a balloon that just got bigger and bigger. My body looks quite different. If you saw a picture of me at that age, you wouldn't recognize that I'm the same person. So therefore, myself and my form is different. I mean, I can remember. How old are you?
5.
So I can remember being 5. I can remember going to school and learning how to read. So I know I was 5. So therefore, I'm the same person I was when I was 5. But the form I had when I was 5 is basically gone. All those cells have changed. So my form and me are different. Do you understand? This form you have now, are you going to have the same form in 10 years? I certainly hope not. So that means that your form and you are different. But you'll remember being this age, right? So you'll be the same person, but your form is different. Well, Krishna's not like that. Krishna, his form is the same. He is his form. He doesn't have a form. He is his form. And that means that as soon as you make a drawing or a carving of Krishna's form, he's there. If you make a carving of my form, I'm not there. You draw a picture of my form, I'm not there. It represents me, but it's not me. Now, if you like me, you'll show that some respect. If you had a photograph of me and you liked me, you might put that photograph on your desk and you'd be, you know, you'd treat it nicely. If you didn't like me, you might put the photograph on your wall and throw darts at it. But my photograph represents me, but it's not me. Whereas with Krishna, as soon as we depict him, according to the instruction of the scriptures, he's actually there. He's actually there. But you'll see him as much as you love him. He's not going to show that he's there to you unless you love him. So if we love him just a little bit, we may look at the deity and say, wow, he looks really beautiful. And we may even see that he looks more beautiful than just like some sculpture in a museum that's, or some, you know, mannequin in a store window that someone's dressed very nicely. We say, you know, he looks more beautiful than we can explain like that. I mean, no, most people don't go to a museum and look at a statue and just like stare at the statue for hours, or, you know, stare at the mannequins in the window for hours in the shop, right? We might say, oh, that looks nice. But we can stand here and stare at the deity of Krishna for hours. So there's something going on here that's a little different than from a marble statue. We may not be able to see that it's Krishna. So to us, we may look and see that it's black marble. But that's not exactly Krishna's color. Krishna's color, as revealed to those who love him, cannot be described by anything material. So we say Krishna's bluish or Krishna's blackish or bluish-blackish. And to our ordinary material eyes, we may see, oh, there we're worshiping him in black marble, or there he's painted very bluish. But when you really see Krishna, and if you worship him nicely, someday he'll come and see you. Then you'll see that his color is very amazing. Now, there's nothing that can describe what is his color. It's something beyond what we can perceive. I mean, even the colors we can see with our eyes in this world, out of all of the light that comes from the sun, like the spectrum is about this big. You can ask your science teacher about this. And we can only see about this much of actual light. We can only see about this much of all of the colors. There are other creatures on this planet who can see things that we can't see. There are creatures who can see infrared and ultraviolet. We can't see those at all. So there are colors even around us that we can't see. What to speak of the color of God. But if you want to know why is he that color, so that's because that color is the essence of love. So that's something that one will have to realize. It's not just something we can understand with our mind. It's not something I can just explain to you logically. But the color of Krishna, that color is actually the essence of love. If love has a color, it is the color of Krishna. Is that all right? Does that make it a little bit more clear? Okay. If you worship Krishna and you chant Hare Krishna, then someday, guaranteed, someday, whenever he wants, so we can't say when it will be, maybe it will be together. Maybe it will be next week, maybe it will be in 20 years, I don't know. But someday, you will see Krishna. And then you will have a hard time describing his color after you see him. Anything else? Oh, if you chant Hare Krishna and you worship Krishna, you'll actually see Krishna. You'll see Krishna just like we're seeing each other here. Krishna will come to you. He'll say, yes, you're worshiping me, you're calling me, I will come. The conditions are you have to call him with love, but he will come. Then you will see his color for yourself. And you will see how he's present there in the deity. That takes some love. Okay, we have time for one more. Anybody else? Yes.
Sometimes in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that he comes as death. So I had a friend who was a devotee for many years, and I was very surprised when his daughter died, and he left. I was very surprised to see my friend. Well, somehow it's my friend. So, when you're seeing Krishna as death, because that's how most people are going to see him, how do we see that sleeping?
So you're saying you have a friend who was a devotee, and after his daughter died, he stopped being a devotee?
Yeah.
He couldn't see Krishna there?
No. I was saying to myself, when that happens, how I will see it sleeping, because he couldn't see it sleeping, even though he'd been playing for a long time. So then I just have to see that unbearable truth.
Krishna says, for one who has taken birth, death is certain, and for one who has died, birth is certain. Death is just one side of the door. It's just like, do you cry when your children graduate from university? That's a kind of death. Do you cry when your children enter puberty? That's a kind of death of childhood. I mean, people do cry at weddings, but they're also happy. In order for something to begin, something has to end. One can see death as the door to a beginning, the door to something fresh. Something like that. And also, I mean, for myself, I had a child die. And I remember at one point, one astrologer said to me, had he lived longer, he would have had great suffering in his life. And then I was completely pacified. I saw that Krishna had actually done a favor to all of us. And looking back now, as my life has played out, I can see that it was a great mercy, although there was some pain at the time. Death is not the worst thing that can happen.
So he says also that when something bad happens to he sanctions that suit or that reaction or the karma. So many times it doesn't matter which place you're in, it's like a Christian sanction. It's your karma.
Well, that's a question that would require at least a half an hour and 45-minute discourse on karma. But we can just say briefly that it's not very fair to blame the delivery person for what we place our order for. So if I place my order for something and then it comes to my door, it's not the fault of the postal carrier. So nothing can happen without Krishna's sanction. That Krishna's sanction doesn't mean it's his desire. If Krishna didn't allow us to do what we wanted and get the results of our actions, then there'd be no freedom. if Krishna only forced us to do what was good for us. So I ask people, I say, okay, I'll move into your house, and I'll bring a gun, and I'll follow you around all day with a gun to your head, making sure you only do the right thing. Anybody want to do that? No takers, huh? Nobody wants to be forced. We all want the freedom to do things that we know are wrong. Don't we? Don't we? Do you? Is everybody here, you want the freedom to do things that you know are wrong? Without Krishna's sanction, we can't do anything. Krishna is our intelligence. Krishna is our ability. Krishna is earth, water, fire, air. Krishna is everything. If he doesn't allow, how can we do something that's wrong? But can we blame him for that? That's not his fault. What would we prefer? Would we prefer to be forced? If he forces us, then yes, we'll only get good things. But is that what we want? We want freedom. Or Krishna could put all the rebellious souls into a state of eternal sleep. But then we never have a chance to go back to him, nor do we have a chance to fulfill all of our desires. So that's very much his kindness. I think that this question really comes from not facing up to the fact that we have desires for things that are very nasty and that we do things that are very nasty. That we tend to think that we're much better people than what we get as our karmic reactions. And we really have a hard time accepting that somebody as nice as me can get reactions that are so nasty. And that's another discussion. But I think that's at the essence of it, really. That we tend to have a very inflated view of ourselves. And therefore, we're not able to accept things with grace and with humility. So one of the keys to spiritual advancement is humility, where one starts to see oneself honestly. One starts to see the real nature of one's desires in this world. Without doing that, one cannot change those desires, or one cannot change one's destiny. I said this is a long topic. I've touched upon a few points, but perhaps I'll be back, Krishna willing, in about 5 weeks, and I do have a talk I give on karma, so maybe I'll give that then, if Krishna allows, if Krishna sanctions. So thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.